This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
In Boulder, a victim's advocate wiped down the kitchen counters of a crime scene while a murdered child lay in the basement. The department refused help from Denver, the FBI, and the Colorado Bureau of Investigation. JonBenet Ramsey's case has been unsolved ever since. Not because the killer was brilliant, but because the people in the room weren't ready and refused to admit it. That was part one in this series. If you haven't watched it, go back, check it out. It's in the feed. Just yesterday. The Nancy Guthrie case is the reason we're here, because the same question about who was in the room and whether they were qualified are playing out right now in Tucson. And the case that I'm about to walk you through, maybe the most dangerous example yet of what happens when an overwhelmed investigation doesn't just miss the truth, it builds a conviction around the wrong one. Literally makes shit up. According to the defense's brief, appellate brief, Richard Allen told his prison psychiatrist he shot the girls. Abby Williams and Libby German were not shot. We're talking about the Delphi case and the missteps there in comparison with what's going on with Nancy Guthrie. But it's kind of a big deal when you're going and getting a confession from someone and they confess to a crime that actually was not committed. A blade was used. Not that. It's not a minor discrepancy. That's not a detail lost in the fog of memory. That's a man allegedly confessing to a crime and getting the cause of death wrong. The single most fundamental fact about how two children's lives ended. And the state of Indiana, in its 94-page response to Allen's appeal, never addresses it. Not once. They call the confessions credible. They call the evidence conclusive and irrefutable. And they never explain how a man supposedly confessing from memory described a manner of death that doesn't actually match reality. This is what happens when the wrong people run an investigation from the get-go. The damage doesn't stay contained to lost evidence or misleads. It builds, it compounds, and eventually it can lead to entire system. So far down the wrong path that the pressure to convict someone, anyone, overwhelms the obligation to convict the right person. If you've been following the Nancy Guthrie case, you already know what it looks like when the initial response raises questions about whether qualified people were in the critical seats. In Tucson, a homicide sergeant with reportedly no homicide experience was dispatched to handle the disappearance. In Delphi, Indiana, a tiny sheriff's department with no experience handling a double murder was handed the most complex case in the state's modern history. Both investigators were shaped permanently. Both investigations, I should say, were shaped permanently by what happened in those first hours and days. The difference is that in Delphi, the investigation didn't just stall. It, in my opinion, and many who actually look at the evidence, put the wrong man in prison for the rest of his life. If you've not heard this story yet and you're like, what is this all about? Well, we got a channel for that. Just look it up. Delphi, Richard Allen, it's all there on our channel. Search it. You will find probably one of the most in-depth resources on the topic. Hundreds and hundreds of interviews and conversations about this case on our channel if you want to go deep. But if you don't know all of it, it's okay. There's a lot to absorb there. I get it. I'll give you kind of a summary. Delphi is a small town in Carroll County, Indiana, population around 3,000. The kind of place where the sheriff's department handles property disputes, DUIs, the occasional domestic. And on February 13th of 2017, two middle school girls, 13-year-old Abby Williams, 14-year-old Libby German, were dropped off by Libby's older sister near the Monon High Bridge Trail for an afternoon walk. Libby posted a video of Abby on Snapchat, and they crossed the old railroad bridge. It was the last image of either girl alive. When they didn't come home, the search began. The next day, both girls were found less than half a mile from the bridge near a creek on private property. Their throats had been, their bodies were partially covered with sticks arranged in patterns that would later become the subject of bitter legal dispute. This was no ordinary crime scene. It was staged, it was deliberate, and it was immediately beyond anything the Carroll County Sheriff's Department had ever confronted. But here's what makes Delphi different from most cold cases. They had evidence from the start. Libby German, with the presence of mind that still takes your breath away, turned on her phone's camera when she sensed something was wrong on a bridge. She captured a grainy 43-second video of a man in a blue jacket and jeans walking towards them. She recorded his voice, those words. The entire country would come to know. Guys down the hill. Some say they hear different things than in the video. Some say they hear Abby saying, "Don't leave me up here." Libby didn't leave. She stayed with Abby, kept her phone recording. And the last thing it captured was the beginning of the end. Eventually, they did go down that hill. So, investigators have a video. They had audio. They had a crime scene with distinctive staging. And within 3 days, they had something else. A man who walked into a local DNR office and voluntarily told an officer he'd been on the trail that same day the girls disappeared. He was concerned. He described what he was wearing, gave him his timeline. His name was Richard Allen. He volunteered the information himself 3 days into the investigation of where he was and how could he help find them. What information could he give them about what he saw on the trail that day? The officer wrote it down, filed it in the system, and then it vanished, mislabeled, lost in a database that a department this size was never equipped to manage. That tip sat in a box for 5 years. This is where the wrong people in the room become something more than an abstract principle. The Carroll County Sheriff's Department didn't fail because it was lazy or corrupt. It failed because it was tiny. And the case was enormous, and the infrastructure to manage that case next simply didn't exist. Agencies poured in from across the state, the FBI, Indiana State Police, officers from surrounding counties. Tips came in by the thousands, eventually over 21,000 of them. But there was no unified command structure, no standardized system for tracking and clearing leads. Officers chased the most interesting tips instead of methodically working through them. It's been described as the road to hell, paved with good intentions. A case where the sheer volume of help actually made things worse because nobody was managing the flow. And there were good tips. There was a lot of people in this case that have not been charged or died or were charged with other crimes and died that may have actually been the real killer, in my opinion. In 2017, police released a composite sketch of a man on the bridge. In 2019, they released a completely different sketch. This one based on a witness who reportedly rated her identification a perfect 10, depicting a younger man in his 20s with curly, poofy hair. And then they arrested Richard Allen, who was 44 with short hair. Looks nothing like the sketches, either of them. The two sketches looked nothing alike. The public was a bit perplexed. The investigation was running in circles and on fumes. And the man whose name was sitting in it, in a misfiled tip, living in Delphi, working at the local CVS, blocks from the police station, watched it all unfold from his front porch for 5 years. That's how long Allen's tip sat unread. Because in reality, Allen's tip really wasn't that exciting. He was there. So were a lot of people. But they ran out of leads. Is there anything we missed? Anything we forgot? And they find this one. And they're desperate. And the public is calling for their heads. And there's an election coming up. And wouldn't it be gee gosh dandy neat if somebody solved this crime right now and somebody certain got elected and we got everybody to shut up and get off our butts for not solving this case for 5 years and monstrously screwing this up and ignoring really solid leads and letting people go and die and all that. Yeah, maybe it'd be good to kind of wipe this slate clean, guys. In my opinion, that's how I feel it went. In 2022, a clerical worker reviewing old files finally found that the timeline matched, the clothing matched, the location matched. Allen was brought in for questioning, and according to investigators, lies, changed his story about when he was on the trail. A search warrant was executed on his home. Police found knives. Are there knives in your home? A .40 caliber handgun and an unspent bullet. Around the same caliber he had found between the girls' bodies, or had been found between the girls' bodies at the crime scene, Allen was arrested and then charged with murder. And then the case got worse. Allen was not housed in the Carroll County Jail. He was transferred to a maximum security state prison. If you're not familiar with how this works, when you're arrested, you go to, like, the county jail. And that's where you sit and you await for your trial. Maximum security prison is where you go if you're found guilty and sentenced. They just kind of skip that whole part, the whole, you know, trial by a jury of your peers. And they just went straight to you're going to the hole. A man who was working at CVS the day before, now in the hole, in a maximum security state prison. Innocent. Charged on extremely flimsy evidence. And you're like, well, that sounds like it might be something. Yeah, I don't have time to go into all of it in this video because we would be making a 12-hour video. But again, if you really want to dive into this case and really hear just how twisted the evidence was against him and how they twisted it to make it fit, go back in the archive. That's all I can say. It's there. And if you walk away from that thinking that they got the right man, I'm sorry, you should probably have your cognitive abilities checked. Because I don't think you're being honest with yourself or anyone else. Or you might just not be mentally sound. Allen was not housed in the Carroll County Jail. He was transferred to the Maximum Security State Prison, Westville Correctional Facility, where he was held in solitary confinement for 13 months awaiting trial. This, like, violates the Geneva Convention. During that time, his mental state deteriorated catastrophically. He was found eating garbage and his own feces, smearing himself with feces, exhibiting psychotic episodes. Mental health evaluators described him as gravely disabled. And during this period of severe psychological breakdown, he began confessing over 60 times, according to the prosecution, to his wife, to his mother, to the prison warden, to a psychiatrist, fellow inmates. The state then built its case around these confessions between bites of poop. I wish I was joking. I'm not, I mean, do I say it for comedic effect to a certain extent? Yes. Do I say it because it's true? Yes. Both are true. This is what is going on. He's literally taking bites like it's a chocolate bar and telling the wardens how he took the girls' lives with a gun. And that's not how their lives were taken. And all those details don't end up in the trial, by the way. The context of all of it, the sound on the video of him in solitary, all that muted. Nobody gets to hear the context that makes it make no sense at all. That this is the ramblings of a madman that is being tortured behind bars to get a confession that a department is so desperate to get, they'll go to any lengths possible. You got this buddy over there at the prison system? We got it. We'll get that for you. We get it. And they're all wearing, and many have Odinist tattoos. Odinism's another, I know. I'm sorry, this is a hard case to discuss because there's so many offshoots in every direction. And when you know it really well, like I unfortunately do, There are so many places to this story where I just want to go. And let's put some context there. Do you have five more hours? Because there's so much here that is so catastrophically wrong with the system and the investigators and the way this whole thing was handled. It's shocking. It's criminal, in my opinion. But the confessions are problems that the state has never adequately addressed. Alan told his psychiatrist he took a gun, shot the girls. Well, that's not how they died. According to the defense's appellate brief, surveillance footage and FBI cell phone data suggest that a white van, which the prosecution used to corroborate Allen's confession, arrived at the relevant location after Libby German's phone had already stopped moving. The state's response to this isn't that the data is wrong, it's that the defense filed the paperwork incorrectly. That's not a rebuttal, that's a dodge. The timeline doesn't match up, basically, if you're trying to follow along there. Where he says he saw the van and where the van actually was at the time doesn't actually match up to reality. But that little factoid, the reality factoid, never makes it to court. And then there's what the jury never saw. Judge Frangal excluded the second composite sketch, the one that looked nothing like Allen, based on the witness who was most confident in her identification. She excluded expert testimony from a forensic witness who would have challenged the bullet-matching methodology the prosecution relied on. Methodology where the initial comparison reportedly came back without a match. There was no actual match. What, there was a bullet there, though. They say it matched his gun. Yes. Again, go back and watch the videos if you want the full details, because it clearly explains the process. Apples to oranges. Apples to tuna is really the comparison that I think should be made between their bullet matching methods. She excluded the alternate theory supported by a Purdue University professor who examined the stick patterns on the bodies and reportedly said it was given that someone was replicating dramatic runic script patterns associated with something called Odinism, a branch of Norse paganism with a known far right strain. And known folks in the community who actively practice this. I know it sounds nuts. Who's practicing Odinism? Apparently a lot of people in Delphi. There's a tattoo shop about it. Many of the people who are rather suspicious in this case have Odinist tattoos. That's not nothing. But according to the investigators, it is nothing. The defense wanted to present evidence that individuals connected to Odinism or that belief system were investigated early in the case and had connections to the area. The judge called it speculative and shut it down. And we're not going to do that. She also required the defense to mute the audio on prison surveillance videos showing Allen in solitary so the jury could see him behaving erratically but never hear the screaming, the psychosis, the context for why a man in his condition might confess to things that aren't true. No DNA linked Richard Allen to the crime scene. No murder weapon was recovered, no fingerprints, no fibers, no blood, no direct eyewitnesses placed him with the girls. The prosecution's physical evidence was a single unspent bullet and confessions from a man who was found gravely disabled, held in conditions his attorneys described as unconstitutional, and who described the wrong manner of death. The jury convicted in under 4 hours. Allen was sentenced to 130 years. That's what happens when you are able to mute reality from a courtroom and a jury only hears what you want them to hear. This is America. This is Delphi, Indiana. His appeal is now before the Indiana Court of Appeals. The state filed its response in late March of 26, arguing the conviction should stand and calling the defense's claims speculative. Allen's attorneys are expected to reply. Whether the appeals court orders a new trial or upholds the conviction remains to be seen as of this recording. But regardless of what happens in that courtroom, the investigative failures are not in dispute. A tip was misfiled for 5 years. The defense alleges 70 days of recorded witness interviews from the initial investigation were lost. The case database couldn't handle the volume. They literally interviewed people, tons of people. People who were very, I would venture to say, one of them might be the real killer. Oh, all those interviews, we lost them. Doesn't exist. We accidentally taped over it on the DVR. Had to get those reruns of Moonlighting in. Just love that, Sybil Shepherd. Okay, it wasn't Moonlighting. I don't know what it was, but they lost it. And it's just, oh, there weren't many consequences anyhow. It's all okay. The initial response was overwhelmed from day one. And the system that eventually produced a conviction did so without forensic evidence linking the defendant to the scene, with confessions that contain a fundamental factual error about the manner of death, and after excluding evidence, the defense argues was central to presenting an alternative theory. Here's a parallel to the Nancy Guthrie case that I keep thinking about. In Tucson, the concern has been about whether Sheriff Nanos built a department around personal loyalty instead of competence, and whether that structure put the wrong people in the room when the critical moment arrived. In Delphi, the problem wasn't a loyalty. It wasn't loyalty appointments. It was institutional incapacity. A department that had never seen anything like this handed a case that would have challenged agencies 10 times its size with no infrastructure to manage the information pouring in. Both investigations were shaped by the same underlying failure. The people making the most important decisions in the most critical hours weren't equipped for what was in front of them. In Tucson, the investigation is ongoing, and the stakes of getting it right are still on the table. In Delphi, the investigation produced a conviction, and the question is whether it produced the right one. That's the most dangerous thing about the wrong people running an investigation from the start. It's not just about lost evidence or missed suspects. It's about momentum. Once a system commits in one direction, once 5 years of public pressure and institutional embarrassment demand an arrest, the incentive shifts. It stops being about finding the truth and starts being about building a case. And when the case you build rests on confessions from a gravely disabled man who got the cause of death wrong, matched by a bullet analysis that initially came back negative, while the defense was blocked from presenting an alternative theory supported by a subject matter expert, you have to ask whether the system found justice or manufactured a resolution. Abby Williams was 13. Libby German was 14. Libby had the courage to record possibly her own killer approaching. We don't know. That's a big assumption to me still, that the guy on the bridge had anything to do with this. And the loyalty to stay with her best friend when everything in her body, must have been screaming to her to run. Those girls deserved an investigation equipped to handle what happened to them from the very first hour. What they got was a system that lost the most critical tip in 3 days, lost months of witness interviews, couldn't manage its own database, and then 5 years later built a case on the words of a broken man in a solitary cell who said he used a gun when the girls were ended with a blade. If Richard Allen actually did this to Abby and Libby, the investigation nearly let him vanish forever. And the conviction rests on a foundation so fractured that it likely, hopefully, will not survive appeal. If he didn't do this to them, then the wrong people in the room didn't just lose evidence or delay justice. They may have made it permanently impossible, because while a system focused on Allen, the real killer, had 5 more years to disappear. Either way, those 2 girls deserve better, and the people of Delphi deserve better. The next family waiting for answers in Tucson or anywhere else where the first people through the door aren't ready for what's behind it deserves to know that this is what it costs. where the system fails in the first hours and then spends years trying to paper over the damage. This is only part two of Beyond Nancy, exposing incompetent investigations. And if you think a misfiled tip and a broken investigation are bad, wait until you hear what happens when the wrong person in the room is wearing a badge and actively working against you. That's coming up next. Press subscribe so you don't miss that. We'll get into it. Love to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We will continue our conversation right there. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.